Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Ayala, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop update on clinical trials, how they work, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this very important topic. Clinical trials is something that really you could never hear enough about. It's such an important topic. We have over 454 participants on the call today. So there are many of you on the call today. And many of you come all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Singapore, Sweden, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really are, it's a bit of a global call with everyone's interest. Now today's program is supported by Celgene Corporation, Taiho Oncology, Inc., and a grant from Genentech, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their collaborative effort in making this program possible. Now, we have the best speakers on today's program. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. Dr. Benson is going to be addressing an overview of clinical trials, why they are important, and the meaning of informed consent. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to join everyone today. When I talk about clinical trials, I often use information from the National Cancer Institute because I think it's very comprehensive and gives the broad scope of the critical issues related to clinical research, and I'll try to touch on some of these important points. Across medicine, but absolutely in cancer medicine, clinical trials are essential to move new methods of preventing, diagnosing, and treating cancer from the laboratory to physicians' offices and other clinical settings, with the goal that we're going to improve care and the quality of life for people with cancer. In clinical trials, these are very carefully designed to test drugs, but not just drugs. We also use clinical trials to evaluate medical devices, screening approaches, behavioral modifications, and other interventions. These trials are used to answer many different clinical questions relative to all aspects of healthcare, such as whether a treatment can prevent cancer in people at increased risk, whether a new drug can extend the lives of patients with advanced cancer, or whether a specific treatment approach can improve the quality of life of an individual. The Food and Drug Administration requires proof of safety and effectiveness of a new anti-cancer drug in clinical trials before they can be broadly used for patients. So that's very important, that when we have drugs available that require FDA approval, the FDA is looking at the clinical trials we have conducted. The greater understanding of cancer and how tumors behave at the molecular level has allowed us to develop a new generation of targeted drugs and immune-based therapies and identify biomarkers that can be used to guide therapy and select patients who are most likely going to benefit from a particular treatment strategy. And this is important because now in our clinical trials, we often are asking individuals to have biopsies or tumor that's available in the pathology department to look at various biological components of a tumor that might help the individual patient in terms of treatment selection, but also guide us in the future how to best utilize a given treatment. Clinical trials are actually viewed as the final step in a very long process particularly for drug development. So in the laboratory, researchers often work for years to look at the effect of a given treatment on cancer cells in the laboratory and in animals, and they also use that opportunity to try to figure out the best dosing of a given drug and certainly any side effects. For each clinical trial, there is at least one person and often many people who are in charge of the trial, and these are referred to as the principal investigators. And the investigators will prepare a plan for the trial, which we often refer to as a protocol. And the protocol is a very detailed document that explains what is done during the trial. And it also provides essential information to make sure that the treatment is administered correctly and appropriately. And so the protocol will say why we're doing the trial, who can join the trial, and that's referred to as eligibility criteria, how many people are needed for the trial to, for example, determine how effective a treatment is. The protocol will discuss drugs or other treatments that will be given, how they'll be given, the dose, and how often. It describes what medical tests must be done and what other types of information will be collected during the course of the trial. Why are these type of clinical trials important? Well, people are living longer lives from successful cancer treatments that are the direct results of past clinical trials. Virtually every cancer treatment we have has been developed through this clinical trial system to determine how safe and effective a given approach might be. There are a number of types of clinical trials, as I alluded to. The most common are referred to as treatment trials, and these are usually drug treatments, but they can also be vaccines or other biological or immunological type treatments. It may be a trial looking at approaches to surgery or radiation therapy. A trial may have combinations of treatments to see if a given combination of drugs might be a more effective strategy. And as I also alluded to, many newer treatment trials now require people to have their tumors tested for genetic changes to see if treatments can target specific genetic changes, and therefore perhaps the treatment will work better. And these treatment trials are designed to make sure we have safe doses for a new treatment, to determine what is the best way the treatment should be given. Can the treatment help people live longer or control their disease for a much longer period of time? And certainly we want to look at any side effects and what is the quality of life for the individuals who are participating. Now, there are also prevention trials, and these often involve healthy people, but prevention trials may also involve people who have had a cancer, may be viewed as cancer-free, and we're looking at ways to help prevent cancer from recurring. There are several types of prevention trials. Some will focus on finding whether actions people take, such as exercising more or eating more fruits and vegetables, as an example, can prevent cancer. So there's a lot of interest in looking at diet, for example. And then there are other trials that focus on whether if you take certain medicines or vitamins or dietary supplements may lower the risk for a cancer. And in these prevention trials, we also want to look at safety, particularly if a drug is given, and does the approach actually prevent cancer. Then there are also screening trials, and the goal of these trials are to focus on looking at new ways to find disease early when it may be more easily treated. And so with these trials, we want to know, does finding the disease earlier make a difference and save more lives? We may look at one screening test compared to another to see if one is superior. And it also defines what tests and procedures work best in this screening situation. Then there are also trials that we call quality of life, supportive care, or palliative care trials. And these can focus on a number of important points, but we want to look at how the cancer and its treatment affect patients as well as their relatives who are helping to care for them. Can it provide better comfort for people who actually have cancer? There are also different phases of clinical trials that I want to briefly mention. So, for example, the earliest type of trial we usually conduct would be a phase one, and this may be a brand new drug or a new combination of drugs to find what is a safe dose. And also it might decide how a treatment should be given. Does it have to be given orally or intravenously? And also to see how the treatment affects the body, including organs such as the kidney and liver. With phase two trials, we're looking more to see if the new treatment has a desirable effect on a certain cancer. And more trials we are doing now are phase two trials because we are looking at very specific biological profiles for individual people. And phase three trials are really designed, they're much larger studies, to compare a new treatment or treatments with a current standard of care. Many of the trials we do are randomized. So that means that the study itself, often by a computer, will determine which arm of a given trial the person will enter. And the randomization is very, very important because it helps prevent bias. And it's a much more robust way to determine if a new drug is really more effective. Many people are concerned that they'll receive a placebo. Actually, in cancer clinical trials, placebos are rarely used. They may be used, however, in prevention trials, and also they may be used in a treatment trial if there is no standard treatment available for an individual, and if we simply don't know if a new treatment will have any benefit whatsoever. And finally, I just want to conclude with informed consent. Everybody who participates in a clinical trial is required to review a written document and sign that document giving their permission to participate in the trial. The team, as they're reviewing informed consent, must describe the purpose of the trial, the procedures, and the risks and benefits. These consents also discuss your rights as an individual, including your right to make a decision about participating and the fact that you can discontinue the participation in the trial at any time. Before agreeing to take part in a trial, you have the right to learn about all of your treatment options. So in a consent process, you should also know what also might be available for you, and it also will describe to you the details about the treatment, the tests, and the possible risks and benefits. That was a quick summary of some of the essential points, but thanks for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was a wonderful summary and excellent, really wonderful way to start the whole program and really clarifying about clinical trials, what they are, how important they are. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Stanford School of Medicine. She's Director, Cancer Survivorship Program, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Shapira is going to be addressing what happens in a clinical trial, how and where clinical trials are conducted, and accessing resources for clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shapira.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. What a pleasure to participate. Let me just continue where my colleague left off. And first of all of us who are on this call feel very strongly that there can be no progress without trials. So our hope is that everybody on this call will feel sort of a sense of partnership with us. We can all help either by enrolling or by talking about it, raising awareness, designing the scientific protocols, or disseminating the results of the scientific information. Just last week, there was an interesting study published here by one of my colleagues about diets and answering one of those questions that we've all had. Is it better to diet using a low-fat or low-carb approach? So all of these questions that we have need to be answered rigorously and scientifically. When you think about clinical trials, we sometimes think about participating in a trial as a mechanism for getting treatment. But there's a whole lot of effort and a lot more thinking that goes into the design of trials than just providing treatment. It's also about providing mechanisms of care, figuring out where somebody can be properly followed after cancer treatment, and as my colleague alluded to, also trying to fine-tune some of the treatments, perhaps looking at doses, perhaps looking at new devices or ways of thinking about care. Even the design of trials is something that is under constant, rigorous scientific review. There are statisticians who sit around the table advising the scientist as to how many patients are needed or what periods of observation are required, how much data is required, because we want these efforts to really count. So the trials are very carefully put together, and we will focus more today on the part of the trial that patients see, but there's a huge amount of effort that goes into designing them properly. There are personnel and scientists who collect data, analyze data, and tell us when we've actually found the answers to the questions that we're trying to answer. There are many reasons to do studies. For instance, our colleagues who are radiation oncologists and deal with children are constantly looking for ways of improving their doses so that the treatment is just or more effective but with less toxicity over the long haul. Those of us who treat adults are thinking constantly about interventions that may minimize the toxicity of the drugs by changing the schedules of administration, by providing supportive measures, whether they're palliation or ways of integrating perhaps even mindfulness therapies or psychological therapies into our treatments to make it easier to bear. Just in the last couple of years, for instance, trials have shown us that there are very useful interventions to deal with fear of cancer recurrence, for instance, which is a very common symptom experienced by many patients who complete their cancer treatment. So what I want to convey is that there is an order to clinical trials, from the design to the delivery to the analysis of data. There are many processes in place for providing oversight so that somebody cannot improvise. The trials need to be vetted. They need to go through very careful processes so there's oversight, and patient advocates are always at the table when scientific reviews or institutional review panels look at these trials very carefully before allowing them to proceed to the clinic. There needs to be a sense of partnership between the clinicians, the clinician scientists, the study personnel, often coordinators, nurses, data scientists, and the patients. And there needs to be a sense of responsibility from everybody that everybody is cooperating towards this common goal of finding new information that will benefit the next generation of patients. People who participate in treatment trials, of course, have an expectation and hope that they themselves will benefit. But the main purpose of clinical trials is for us all to generate the knowledge that will then allow us to move the field forward. So it's really thinking not just about oneself, but the future generations of patients that should lead an individual to decide to participate in a trial. Sometimes we ask a lot of patients. We ask them to undergo biopsies, to be followed for years, to accept that responsibility, and sometimes we ask very little. And we often use the term risk to denote the kind of responsibility that we are that we understand that we are asking for our partners in research, the patients. So thinking about it along those lines, it's also important to understand that some of these trials can be conducted in community settings, in office settings, for instance, and those are the trials that are what I would say more mature, where we're testing perhaps a new medication in addition to a standard treatment. But some of these studies, such as the ones that Dr. Benson mentioned called phase one studies or the first in human studies, really require a very committed team, and those are typically only offered at academic sites where there is a personnel that is trained to watch and monitor this, mostly for the patient's safety as well as to be able to collect more information. So some studies can be conducted in a doctor's office, whereas others have to be conducted at academic centers. You can find out a lot of information about trials because they're registered by the NCI. So if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, the website from the National Cancer Institute, you can find out information about studies that is typically in lay language. You can also find additional resources about trials from other websites. The one that I'm particularly engaged in is cancer.net, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology's website for the public, and that provides basically a nonpartisan education about clinical trials. So my comments basically are quite general, but address the fact that this is an orderly process that is necessary for progress, that there is oversight, that there should be a sense of partnership between those deciding to participate and the scientific team, that there are many different roles within the scientific team. Some of these involved personnel have direct contact with patients participating, and others may be removed, but everybody is committed to handling that data with respect and with rigor and also in a very confidential way. There are plenty of resources about trials. Not all trials require the same degree of involvement, so it's important to have an open mind. And some really expose the participants to very low levels of risk, and those are typically studies where the investigators are trying to learn more about the experience of living with cancer and even the experience of being a caregiver to somebody with cancer. So hopefully with everybody's help, we can make progress along all of these lines, both finding new treatments specifically to treat cancer, better ways of preventing, and also better ways of supporting patients and families throughout the cancer journey. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shapira, and thank you for covering the range of trials also, and that there are trials also for people who are caregivers. That's really important to mention as well. Thank you for having mentioned that, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Donald Northfelt. Dr. Northfelt is Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, Consultant, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Mayo Clinic, Phoenix, Arizona. And Dr. Northfelt is going to address the benefits and risks of participation, how you may participate in a clinical trial, and specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Northfelt.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm grateful to Dr. Benson and Dr. Shapira for providing such a comprehensive background on the topic. I have the three points to address, as Dr. Messner mentioned, and I'm going to try to provide three bullet points about each of these topics. The first topic was to discuss benefits and risks of participation in clinical trials. So in terms of benefits and risk, point number one would be that the benefits in participating in clinical trials, from my perspective, are that you are involving yourself in a process that some very bright people from around the country or around the world have come together to determine would be a useful approach to questions involving your care. So I always tell my patients, you're not just getting an opinion from me or a direction from me in participating in a clinical trial, you're really getting second, third, fourth, fifth opinions from the brightest people on the planet in terms of how to address your disease or your concern. Point number two is regarding the risks. There are always going to be risks in participating in clinical trials, particularly when novel treatments or novel strategies are being employed that have never been tested extensively in the past. Those kinds of risks should be very clearly outlined in the informed consent document that you are asked to sign. In addition, the clinician who is presenting the concept of the clinical trial to you should be very clear in their discussion of what risks you face. And the third point I'd like to make is that you can walk away from a discussion about a clinical trial, read the copy of the consent form that you are given. You may generate more questions in your reading and thinking about it once you've left the doctor's office. At that point, you should definitely call back and contact the clinician or contact the study coordinator and get those questions answered so that you fully understand the risks and benefits of participation before you proceed. The second question I've been asked is, how may you participate in a clinical trial? And there are a variety of ways to do this. Dr. Benson was mentioning to us before we came on the call today that many patients don't get the opportunity to participate in clinical trials because no one ever mentioned to them that a clinical trial was available. And this is a great frustration to us who depend on the results of clinical trials to direct us toward the best care for our patients. It is vital that when clinical trials are available for your condition, that somebody tells you that. Now, you can try to rely on your care provider to do so, but it shouldn't stop there. There are resources all over the internet and in other places where you can inquire about the availability of clinical trials that may serve your needs. Clinicaltrials.gov is a website that was mentioned by Dr. Shapira a moment ago. That's a comprehensive source of information about clinical trials available in the United States for cancer care. So that's a very fundamental website that everyone should be aware of. But in addition to asking your care provider, there are other resources, as I mentioned, the Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, and others, where information about clinical trials can be sought. And it's not a shame on your provider if you show up with a printout from clinicaltrials.gov or another listing of clinical trials and inquire with your provider, is this something that would benefit me? Is this something that I should consider? The third point I've been asked to address is, what specific questions should you ask your healthcare team about clinical trials? And this is a rather broad topic. I would say, number one, have your care providers reiterate to you what they perceive the benefits to be and what they perceive the risks to be in your participation in the clinical trial. It is also vital that your alternatives be discussed and listed for you for your consideration. In any cancer situation, there will be investigational options, clinical trials. There will also be conventional treatment options about which you should be aware. There may be a time when a clinical trial is presented to you as an option, but after thinking about it and hearing about a conventional treatment option, you may choose that as a better alternative for yourself, depending on your circumstances. So it is a requirement, really, that your care provider provide you with all of the conventional treatment options available to you, as well as any clinical trial options, to allow you to make a fully informed choice about your treatment. And then the last thing I would say with respect to questions for your healthcare team would be to ask whether this is something that they would choose for themselves. I think that most of us want to be frank with our patients about our enthusiasm about a clinical trial, and there have been times when we've had clinical trials available at my location where I did not think that was the best choice for the patient. And in being asked, would I do that myself, it allows me to have some reflection about that and provide perhaps a more thoughtful answer to the patient about whether the clinical trial would be worthwhile for them. So I've covered risks and benefits. I've covered how you might find a way to participate in a clinical trial. And I've covered specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials. That concludes my contribution, and I'll hand it back now to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Nordfeldt. That was amazing and wonderful. And I have to say that you really did cover all these topics, and they're all topics that people may have further questions about. I appreciate, thank you very much for your presentation. And before we go into questions, I just want to say a few words about the services you can access from Cancer Care. So Cancer Care does provide free psychosocial programs and services, and they're delivered by trained oncology social workers. And so just to give you a brief summary of them, we do offer practical and financial assistance. We do also offer counseling services, both on the telephone and online. We have many different types of online support groups, about 120 online support groups right now in many different topics. And we also do a number of telephone support groups as well. We also offer the opportunity to have individual counseling, and you can either call Cancer Care at our 800 number, or you can simply visit our website and pose a question, and you'll be connected to one of our oncology social workers. So you kind of, for people who prefer to use our website, you can contact us through the website, and that's true for international participants as well as U.S. participants. And we also can provide resources to you, and a number of our speakers have mentioned resources during the call, and those resources, so if we can't provide it, we can connect you to other organizations that provide it, and that's pretty much what we're doing. There are so many other, I think there's over 1,000 actually charitable organizations that offer different types of services for specific types of cancers, and so that we would kind of help you to link to others as others link to us. We all kind of link together. So we most importantly don't want anyone to feel that you're alone, that, you know, there's a lot of information to incorporate from a program like this today. We want you to know that your healthcare team, of course, is vital, but also sometimes these other resources can really help you to find your way. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Ayala to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to also ask her to bring all of our speakers on board so that we can really take all your questions. We're going to try to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your question, I will explain to you at the end how to get your questions answered. So, but let's see how many we can take right now. Ayala?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question is from Stephanie Kay. Your line is now open.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. Another excellent seminar, workshop. I have two questions. My first question is, how do you know if something is, if it's been FDA approved, like we're talking about the clinical trials, but if the FDA approval for this particular, for example, machines, like the laser therapy machines that they're talking about, there's many types of them. If they're FDA approved and says that, how do you know that it is gone through clinical trials, these machines like they're using now for lymphedema and peripheral neuropathy, comparing like the cold laser therapy versus the hot laser therapy versus the tense machines and scramble machines. And also I heard another doctor talk about vitamins. How do you know about that? If these particular vitamins are, again, if they say FDA approved, did they go through clinical trials? Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stephanie. Those are very interesting and important questions. I'm going to ask if Dr. Shapiro, if you could start with those questions, and then we'll see who else would like to weigh in on them as well.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not an expert in the device certification. I don't know exactly how to answer that question. Perhaps one of my colleagues knows better how the FDA grants certification for laser machines or others whether there's a, you know, what the process looks like. So I'm afraid I can't quite answer that.
I could. I'm not an expert on devices either, but I can tell you devices are handled very, very differently and often are not evaluated by randomized clinical trials to determine if one type of machine is the same or better than another. It's a very different process than what must be done for drug treatment trials.
Excellent. Thank you. And yeah, I think should another. Oh, yes.
Yeah, yes. I'm sorry. It's Don Northup. My understanding is that the FDA approves devices based on demonstration of safety, but there's no requirement that efficacy be demonstrated in order to gain FDA approval for a device.
You're
so
right.
It remains kind of a Wild West in terms of was one laser better than another. There's never going to be any evidence developed at the level of FDA approval to say that one laser is better than another. And I'll just make a further comment about the vitamin supplements. You know, the American Institute of Cancer Research and the American Cancer Society and other organizations discourage the use of vitamin supplements in general for cancer indications because there is no evidence from randomized clinical trials to support any claims about vitamin efficacy in any realm of cancer care. So the FDA decided, based on political pressure, I believe, not to require vitamin and supplement manufacturers to put their products through rigorous randomized clinical trials. It's sort of a loophole that the FDA allowed them to slip through. So any claims about the value of vitamin and mineral supplements or other kinds of nutritional supplements for cancer patients must be viewed very cautiously, or I would say skeptically, because there's not evidence of the sort that Dr. Benson has been discussing to tell us that those strategies are useful.
Oh, thank you. That's really very helpful. And I think also, Stephanie, you may want to contact the American Cancer Society. They actually do have I wanted to call out to them. They have a 365-day a year, 24-hour a day. So they're always open. They're never closed for a holiday or anything. And their number is 1-800-227-2345 or www.cancer.org. And they actually have a cornucopia of information for any question that you might have, and they could link you also to places that, you know, could help you with your questions. But I think the issue of vitamins, do others want to comment on that as well? It is an important, I know it comes up on a lot of our calls, and I thank you for addressing it, Dr. Northfeld, because it's a very important topic. It also, sometimes if you're in the midst of treatment, of course, then sometimes vitamins can interact with your chemotherapy treatments or your radiation treatments. So it's very important to actually let your doctor know exactly what you're taking, any vitamin or supplement or even an herbal tea sometimes. Do others want to comment on that? What is that? Okay. All right. Then anyone, Dr. Shapiro, do you want to say more about that? Or is that?
No, I appreciate my colleague's wise comments. I too am sometimes struck by the fact that many patients want to take vitamins because they feel they're helping themselves, but it's a bit unregulated, and the interaction between vitamins and cancer treatments may potentially be unhelpful or even harmful. So I think that the note of caution that was sounded is both appropriate and really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. So thanks. That was a good question and an excellent response to its very important dialogue here. Thank you. And our next question, Ayala.
Our next question is from Sue O. Your line is now open.
Hi. I think it's for Dr. Benson, but I know the importance of clinical trials because my oncologist, Kanti Rai, has wiped out chemotherapy for CLL, and he has all these pills out. I am an animal activist, but this is not what I want to really know is why do they need to use animals, and when you're using people and why harm the animal who did not volunteer for this when people, their bodies are not like ours? Why just stick to using people?
So thank you for that question. Dr. Benson, can you address this in a general way?
Yes. Unfortunately, cancers are phenomenally complex. And before we do complicated human clinical trials, we have to have a much better understanding of the various permutations that can go on with research in terms of trying to figure out, for example, what is the molecular characteristic of a tumor, what are possibilities in terms of different types of drugs that might work. And we have no perfect model, but with the animal models, we can get much more proof of principle information and biological understanding. So, for example, we can take a human tumor, implant that tumor in a mouse, and much of this work is in mice, for example. And we can, through series of experiments, we can do things like imaging with these mice and a number of experiments to determine if a given approach is even worthwhile pursuing. And in the laboratory, there are many, many failed experiments. And that's important because we don't want to move forward with an intervention that has no hope of helping a person. And so what we call preclinical work is essential. And we certainly do a lot of work with cells and petri dishes and so forth, but that environment of testing is not the same as when you actually have a tumor in a living animal, for example, like a mouse. And the idea here is to make sure that when we begin experimental therapies for humans, we have the essential background information, because we could give a therapy, if we didn't have this background, that could result in the death of a person, which is absolutely the last thing we want to see. So before we begin a treatment in human beings, we have to have this type of background. And it's not perfect. Animal work is not perfect, but it gives us essential information about how a drug may work and information about the safety of a drug before we move forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Manson. And does anyone wish to comment further on that? Or very well. Excellently explained, I think. And so we now have another online question for one of our participants. So this particular question I'd like to direct to Dr. Shapiro. Will I be seeing my regular cancer doctor if I'm on a clinical trial? Who will be in charge of my care during the clinical trial? So Dr. Sure. Shapiro, if you could address that question.
Sure, it's a great question. Most of the time, the answer is yes, but it depends on the particular trial and the institution. So, for instance, in some institutions, if you are on a clinical trial of a very new concept or new drug, phase one study, then there may be a dedicated team of people who really understand that particular new drug very well, who may be supervising your care, and your regular oncologist may just, you may or may not see him or her on a regular basis while you're on the trial. There may be other trials and other institutions where the treatment tested is more mature and it can be easily administered and overseen by your regular oncologist. So it depends on what study and what setting you're in. In many places, if you are receiving the experimental treatment where you normally get your care, every effort is made to keep your regular oncologist in the loop, but it may require, again, as I said earlier, some shared visits or perhaps alternating with experts in that particular treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Does anyone wish to comment further? And we have another online question, I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Northfeldt. How do I know which clinical trial is best for me? What if my primary care doctor is not overly excited about the clinical trials? Should I get a second or third opinion? Dr. Northfeldt, if you could address this in a general way.
Sure. I think the doctor who's caring for you consistently is the one who probably has the greatest insight into your needs and into what would be valuable for you. So I would put a lot of stock in the opinion of your primary oncologist to direct you toward a cancer clinical trial that would be appropriate for you. I think that it's smart to be skeptical and to ask detailed and specific questions of your regular oncologist to allow him or her to justify their thought that this clinical trial is correct for you. And I always think it's important that the patient press the primary oncologist to let them know, is there any other alternative that I should be considering? So you have to be your own best advocate in a sense and maintain an air of skepticism to get a sense from your oncologist that this is truly something that's going to be appropriate and the best for you at this time.
Excellent. Thank you. Anyone else wish to comment? Or okay. And we have another telephone question. Ayala?
Our next question is from Edmund E. Your line is now open.
Yes. I have a question. When I was first diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma 18 years ago, I went to a academic major medical center and I was offered a clinical trial, and I did some research and found that the drug under investigation was very toxic to the bone marrow, and I rejected that one and then went on the government website and found another trial that was being done at that same institution with a vaccine, and which is the one I went for, and I'm still going after 18 mm-hmm. years. My question really is, what is the competition among academic medical centers to accrue patients, and is there coordination among the different investigators?
And Edmund, we certainly want to congratulate you on your self-advocacy and also on your 18 years later, so that's really quite impressive. So I'm going to ask Dr. Northfeldt if you could address that question.
Sure. There's healthy competition, I would say, between various academic medical centers and also between pharmaceutical companies to enroll patients in their studies. Here at the Mayo Clinic, of course, we think we have all the best ideas, and I'm sure at the University of Chicago, similarly, they think they have all the best ideas. Well, if there's that kind of competition existing in the marketplace, so to speak, that's going to be to the advantage of the customer, in other words, the patient who's looking for the best clinical trial. So if you have the opportunity to go to more than one place and ask, what have you got for me here? And then the next place, what have you got for me here? It sounds like you were being a smart shopper, sir, and investigating on your own behalf to find the clinical trial that ended up being very favorable for you. So I applaud you for that, and I think patients, to the extent that they're able, should take advantage of this friendly competition that goes on between pharmaceutical companies and various academic centers, because we all want to push our ideas as being what we think are the best. But make us justify that to you before you make your decision.
I think you should also know that there is also extensive collaboration. So many, if not the majority of trials, are conducted at multiple centers. Now, for some of the large trials, there may be hundreds and hundreds of centers across the country that are participating in the same trial. There are other smaller trials that may involve far fewer centers because far fewer numbers of patients are required to reach the study endpoint. Also, there are often multiple trials at the same time for the same situation. And that is often encouraged so that we enhance development of new treatment strategies. And in those situations, it's not that one trial is better than another, but for an individual, if there are multiple trials, asking questions about side effects and so forth and the schedule of the drug and so forth are important and may guide the individual in making that particular decision.
Excellent, thank you. And we have another online question. And this question I'm going to, I'll say a few words about it and I'll ask Dr. Shapira also to comment on it. Some patients are unable to participate in clinical trials due to transportation issues or other various practical factors. Are there any clinical trial specific resources for patients for such patients, are there any funds set aside for transportation or childcare, et cetera? So I'll just say something about that initially. Just I'm an oncology social worker, and I just want to say a few words about most settings, of course, do have oncology social workers, they have case managers, patient navigators, as well as oncology nurses, and so and your own healthcare, your own physician as well. If indeed those issues prevent you from participating in a clinical trial, please let your physician know, and then he will refer you to the people on the team who might be able to help you connect with resources. And there are not just resources in your institution, but also resources in organizations like Cancer Care or the American Cancer Society or many of the other organizations that exist throughout the country, that although they may be national in scope or they may be a local organization that could assist you with those practical issues. And Dr. Shapira, do you want to add anything to that as well?
I think that's a brilliant answer and a very good point. I've heard it said, for instance, that those kinds of factors, living far away from a center where trial is conducted, often stops patients from participating, say if it's demanded by the protocol that they travel, say, 8 hours for a blood draw on a day that they're not going to get treated. That may just make it impossible for somebody to participate. So on the so that's a good comment for those of us on the research design side to bear this in mind, and I think we need to find ways of making it easier for people to participate. Dr. Messner brought up the idea that that one must just ask for an opportunity to speak to a social worker, to see if there are funds locally set aside, reach out to national organizations that have funds set aside for this. In fact, I've done some work with a foundation called the Lazarek Foundation, which is interested also in helping fund travel and all of these costs for patients who are looking to participate in an early phase clinical trial, but would not be able to do so without some financial help just to get there. So I think this is a very timely question, and each one of us should get involved in trying to make it easier for people to participate.
I should also add that in surveys, transportation, even for people not on a trial, is a huge factor and one that we need to routinely try to address, because for many people, it's just so difficult to even get to their medical center.
That's such an excellent point, Dr. Benson. I would say that Cancer Care does offer like transportation assistance, and it's the biggest request we have of all of our financial grants in terms of home care, child care, help with some of your medical costs, but the transportation requests are the greatest. And so that is a big issue for people, absolutely. And the more you can let your team know that, and the more you can also call different organizations. We'll give you resources at the end of the program. There's an evaluation that you'll all get. It will have the resources we've discussed during the program itself, But any one of those organizations we will give you would also be able to refer you, because they make the nonprofit organizations have a whole database of other organizations in your community or throughout the nation that might be able to help you, or even internationally. So it's very important to raise the questions, to remind everybody about those practical needs that you have. It's very important, because we really want people to be able to participate in trials, and yet this such a basic practical issue is impeding some people from doing that. So we want to kind of circumvent that in some way or help with that. And we have, this will be our last question. This question I'm going to ask Dr. Benson, if you could address this. Is long-term follow-up care part of the study? What would it involve?
So trials vary tremendously how long an individual might be followed. So for many trials, long-term survival of the individual is a critical endpoint. And so in those type of trials, people are monitored lifelong. Now, that often is, at that point, the individual is receiving standard of care and has just regular office visits, but we have to report how the individual is doing as part of the research record. Other trials, once the person has completed the therapy, there may be very limited follow-up after that. And when we talk about follow-up in a trial, that's more in terms of what we have to report as part of the research project. In most trials, we work very hard to maintain standard of care. So if a person has completed their therapy, we would follow routine standard of care follow-up as dictated by the disease. And that can vary. So there are some people, for example, in my practice, there are some people where I just need to see them once a year. There are other people I have to see them every 2 weeks or so. So it varies by the disease. But when we talk about follow-up in a trial, it's really what we are reporting as part of the study endpoint, and those endpoints do vary a great deal.
Excellent, thank you. And although I said that was the last question, there's one more late-breaking question, so we'll take this one as well. And I'm going to ask Dr. Shapira to address this. How long is the process from when a patient agrees to participate in a trial and when the trial will begin? Dr. Shapira, if you
could
address
question
that.
And a variable answer. Typically, there is a list of things that need to be done to make sure that even if the patient is interested and signs a consent, that he or she meets the criteria to participate in the trial. Sometimes a tissue sample needs to be processed, or sometimes tests need to be done or records obtained. But typically, I would say it's no more than a small number of weeks. Sometimes it can be immediate. So anywhere between hours and a small number of weeks.
Excellent. Thank you. And, well, there's one comment, so and then we will wrap up. So someone has written a comment that ChemoCars provides free on-demand rides to and from chemotherapy via Uber and Lyft. So that's something you might want to ask your team about, and that's, thank you for that recommendation. So we have actually a very active, I have to say our participants today have been very active in asking questions and providing resources, so thank you all. And I want to thank our speakers. They've been outstanding. This has been an amazing, we've done this call a number of times. This, I have to say, has probably been the most exceptional clinical trial call we've ever done. Our speakers are terrific, and the questions have been amazing. So I want to thank everybody, and I want to also acknowledge that, indeed, if we didn't get your question, I said I would give you a resource to contact. So if we didn't get your question, or any medical questions that you may have, of course your healthcare team is, of course, the go-to, because they know the most about you, absolutely. However, you also may call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, because they actually have lots of information about clinical trials. or you could visit their website at www.cancer.gov, and we'll send that information to you. What's nice about their website is they have a live chat feature. And that live chat feature allows you to post a question. So anywhere in the world, you can post that question, or in the U.S., and one of their information specialists will get back to you. And then, of course, you know, all the resources that we've mentioned during the call, and you'll be getting that, they're all resources also to help you with any sort of medical questions in addition to your healthcare team. And if you have any emotional or social or practical questions that you have, or just any questions that you just want to run by someone, do, you know, keep the number for Cancer Care in your pocket, but there are many other organizations as well. But I would just call us at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancer.gov. www.cancer.org is at the Cancer Care, you'll get all that information from us. But most importantly, as we conclude the call today, I don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with a cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of a huge network of supportive services, and really to take advantage of those services. You know, I think that it's just so important that everyone on the call, you know, takes this information, uses it, goes back to your healthcare team. Perhaps we hope that the call will help you to ask more informed questions of your healthcare team. You'll feel more confident. You've gotten a lot of support from everyone on the call today to go ahead and ask questions of your healthcare team, whatever's troubling you. And also in terms of your participation in clinical trials, any questions you have, go back to your healthcare team. And as I think both our speakers and our participants have also commented on the fact that they actually, I think it was Edmund who actually said that, you know, he researched about trials and went back and found something that he found was more helpful to him. So I think that it's important to have that open dialogue with your healthcare team. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.